This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the U.S. political landscape in 2016. The 114th U.S. Congress begins a new session. President Obama girds for the last year of his presidency. And yes, campaign 2016 ramps up in advance of the first primary elections. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In this presidential election year, many analysts don't expect many laws to be passed. In fact, the first major order of business in 2016 for the Republican-controlled House of Representatives was to pass legislation to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The Senate passed the bill last year. Naturally, U.S. President Barack Obama has vowed to veto the legislation aimed at dismantling his signature domestic achievement. In any case, it appears that the Republicans have yet to coalesce around a plan to replace it. For his part, President Obama rallied his Democratic base by announcing several executive actions he plans to take to curb gun violence, saying that Congress has refused to act. Statistics show that the majority of Americans are in favor of reasonable gun safety measures, which do not violate the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. But the powerful gun lobby, the NRA, has consistently lobbied against them. And the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign is about to kick into high gear in the run-up to the February 1st caucus vote in the Midwestern state of Iowa, followed shortly thereafter by the first presidential primary in New Hampshire on February 9th. This year, President Obama will deliver his final annual State of the Union address next week, several weeks earlier than usual, presumably to set a tone for the electorate in advance of the presidential primaries. Well, with us to discuss the politics and policies likely to dominate Washington in 2016 are two veteran political analysts, John Fortier and Igor Volsky. John Fortier is a political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a centrist policy group based here in Washington. And Igor Volsky, he's now deputy director at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Good to be with you.
And Happy New Year. John Fortier, let me begin with you. Seems like all politics this year with the election taking place. We have the repeal of Obamacare, first order of business by the House of Representatives. Seems to be symbolic because Obama, of course, vows to veto it. What do you see as the legislative agenda for 2016?
Well, I do think it's symbolic. I think sometimes people make fun of Republicans for consistently bringing this up and having it shot down, and the president will certainly not agree with them that they should repeal what he had his first term or first couple of years chief legislative accomplishment. But if you look at the polls, American people are still pretty divided and somewhat negatively inclined towards the president's Health Care Act. It will be a significant issue on the campaign trail. And as much as, you know, it will be difficult to find a replacement if a Republican presidential candidate comes out of the race and wins and keeps control of Congress, which is not inconceivable, you will see significant changes. Difficult to find a replacement, but I think you will see ultimately a very significant change in rolling back of some of the president's plans. So it is political in a sense. It is something that Republicans will still keep talking about. Democrats feel strongly about it, but many people are still opposed to the legislation. So I don't think it's a worthless thing for them to do. As for substantive things, I think we had a burst of some substantive activity in the end of 2015. It was a little bit unexpected. You don't think you're going to see so much at the end of a presidential term, but a confluence of events with the new speaker and the president and some deals were cut. But as we move forward, we have very little time to get things done legislatively. Come June or July, really, the Congress is almost going to shut down and the election will be upon us. So I don't expect we're going to see a lot more get done. We'll see more political things like this to highlight the differences between the campaigns.
Turning to you, Igor Volsky, for your take on the legislative agenda 2016 and, of course, the action by the House of Representatives to repeal Obamacare. John Fortier saying, certainly a political move, but not just purely symbolic. There's a lot of discontent, even among some people in the electorate. certainly among Republican lawmakers.
I do have to disagree with John just a little. I think it will certainly be a political issue, but on the national level and in the presidential race, it's almost been muted. You don't hear the Republican presidential candidates talking about it because it's not profitable to do so on the main stage when you're talking to the entire country, when you're trying to make yourself more sellable, certainly in the general election. That's partly because millions of people now have health care coverage. Of course, when you break it down to congressional districts, which are incredibly gerrymandered, those votes make sense for those representatives because that's what their constituents in the districts that elect them want, is yes, for them to try to once again, for the 60th time, to repeal Obamacare.
Just quickly define gerrymander for our audience.
A gerrymander is the process of carving out districts that group similar people together so that the district isn't as competitive as it would be otherwise.
Quickly, before I turn back to John Fortier, would you agree, too, that quite a bit was done before the turn of the new year under the new speaker, Paul Ryan? A budget was passed, funding for the federal government. So does that augur well for 2016?
Well, I think it was a very good thing for the country, not a very good thing for Republicans, who now no longer have any must-pass pieces of legislation to attach any of their conservative priorities to. So when the president issued his executive actions, for instance, on guns, there's no vehicle that they could attach any legislative effort to undo those actions. That for them maybe is a problem. But yes, certainly for the country, the fact that we actually got something done substantive is a very good thing.
Well, turning to you, John Fortier, and let's pick up on Obama's executive action on guns again. Some see it as a political move. Others see this as a very important measure, common sense gun regulations that would reduce gun violence here in this country and still be consistent with the Second Amendment to keep and bear arms. These are executive actions, some would say, are very modest, but nonetheless welcome. They would require gun sellers to get licenses, more gun buyers to undergo background checks, basically tightening the enforcement of existing gun laws. But this will require, some say, allocation of funds, particularly when it comes to increasing mental health treatment, which is also part of those executive actions. How do you see Congress reacting?
Well, in the big picture, the president has been faced with a Republican Congress, or partially Republican Congress, really since after his second year. And we've had divided government. We have differences of opinion. It's hard for the president to get things through the legislature. And consistently, he has moved to the point of trying to find ways to do things through executive actions on controversial issues, whether it's climate change or guns or Cuba, foreign affairs and Iran deal. There are a lot of things that the president does not require Congress's help on. Those are controversial. Republicans argue in many ways he's overstepping his grounds. The courts will have to decide whether he's gone too far in some of the things that he's done. And I think we'll have some fights about how you fund it. I guess on the gun issue, I would say this. Americans are divided, but the parties aren't so divided anymore. It used to be you had Democrats, a lot of kind of more pro-gun Democrats and pro-gun control Republicans. Today, the parties are pretty homogeneous on that. So the president doesn't have a lot of his congressional members he's looking out for trying to preserve their electoral prospects. So he's been more outspoken against guns than Bill Clinton or others, who was more muted in his criticism. You know, the American people are divided in this way, that yes, you can look at polls and say some of these are common sense measures, but American people are also for things like the ability of Americans to carry concealed weapons or to carry them more openly, to use them to protect themselves. I think on this issue, it's not the little things. Should we tighten up this loophole? People view it as the president is really trying to go at and move in a direction away from protection of gun rights, or the president, if you're a Democrat, is trying to really save the country by taking guns away from people who shouldn't be there. It's the big issues. Therefore, I don't think Republicans feel like they're going to pay a price. I think they feel strongly that the president will be seen and Democrats will be seen as anti-gun, even if it's on these smaller measures that are generally popular. The president's signal is, hey, I'm really on the side of controlling guns and not enough on the side of the Second Amendment.
Igor Volsky, for your view on this, certainly President Obama seems against the wall. You know, he's tried many times to get legislation through the Congress, background checks. Some see this as very simple and common sense. Others, like John Fortier, say, see, this is he's trying to remove guns from people who want to protect themselves, and we're seeing a spate of attacks that prompt some to say they would like to defend themselves. So what does President Obama get out of doing this right now?
Well, I think he certainly rallies up the Democratic base, but he also rallies up the American people. I mean, 90% of Americans support expanding background checks. And the reason why, though, others feel that he's taking away their guns with these actions is because, let's be very honest and frank, the NRA lies about these actions or any kind of real conversation about gun safety, because all they want to do is pretend that this infringes your Second Amendment rights, which we should recall is actually a fairly modern argument that was invented in the 1980s. You know, the first federal gun safety law was passed in 1934 under Franklin Roosevelt, and the chief NRA lobbyist was in front of Congress tacitly supporting the action. He was asked by a senator, do you think this law, which bans certain kinds of like really gangster type weapons, undermines the Constitution? And the lobbyist literally said, I have not given this that much thought. So the idea that Second Amendment prohibits anyone from regulating guns in any way is really an NRA-funded effort to not have a serious conversation. You know, the concealed carry piece, for instance, I mean, the orders do nothing about concealed carry. That's a state issue. So if we want to talk about the orders specifically, we can, but I think we also have to understand that these are relatively modest steps because, of course, to go further, he needs legislative action, which he's not going to get because a lot of these Republicans are funded by the NRA.
But what about even an allocation of funds for mental health care?
But it doesn't even get to that level of debate, Carol, because they immediately say all of this, A, undermines congressional authority because he's acting like a king, which is not true. I mean, Ronald Reagan had 381 executive orders. They didn't really care about that. But also, they just don't want to debate the specifics. They want to keep it at 30,000 feet because that stokes the fear. And that has really two purposes. One is to freak out the NRA members, 4 million members, to continue paying their dues to the NRA and enriching the NRA. And number two, to ensure that people, every time Obama talks about gun safety, run to the gun stores and buy guns, and which enriches gun manufacturers. So, I mean, this is pretty clear and transparent. And to have this conversation as if there's kind of two very sensible sides to this is really quite silly when the other side is doing all it can to not even have a rational conversation, as you point, about what these orders actually are, like the 500 million.
Well, certainly both sides are playing politics.
See, but I don't think they are. I don't think when you have 90% of the American people saying we support expanding background checks, I don't think there's any politics here. It's a human issue now to say that the only people who should have guns are people who can handle having guns. That's not politics when Democrats, when Republicans, when NRA members support expanding background checks. It's only controversial among the members who are funded by the NRA.
Let's go back to something. If you remember after Sandy Hook, which was one of our tragedies, and there have been others since then, there was a lot of momentum to do something, and there were potential votes in the Senate, and people worried that those votes on these types of issues, on background checks and other things, were being blocked. Well, also being blocked were amendments that were going to more broadly allow people to carry weapons. There are a lot of sensible things that go in the other direction that the American people believe in that are expansive of gun rights. So I think it's not unnatural that people take this view of, well, is the president really trying to move away from gun rights, or is he trying to move towards it? And they see him as trying to move away from it unilaterally. I disagree with Igor that it's just a lobby. There's a strong public opinion broadly in support of gun rights. Gonna, you know, argue that, whether it's rural versus urban, and whether that's going to change over time, but it's still a very strong force in public opinion, not just in a lobby of a few people.
But John, and certainly, let's move on to another topic. Let me just say this, though, that there's certainly now a growing lobby on the side of gun safety measures, which is trying to counter the National Rifle Association. So we will see in the coming weeks and months how that will play out. And now let's move on to executive orders, which Mr. Obama, as a result of, or by example, reduction of gun violence measures, is showing that he's going to be using more and more executive orders. Do you think, John Fortier, that he is overreaching, or is he really doing any more than any other presidents? Just as Igor said, President Reagan used some over 380 executive orders. Is that really why is Mr. Obama being attacked for the use of executive orders when many others have used them before him, Republicans included?
Look, there's always a tension between the two branches. The Congress is supposed to write the laws and the president is supposed to administer them, and there's some leeway in how the president administers them. So you're always going to have some back and forth of whether he's gone too far. I will say, whether he's gone too far or not, he has certainly used this as his main way of emphasizing and pushing forward his issues. I could say, you know, essentially he has almost given up on working through Congress. Whether you're a Democrat, you think, oh, it's the Republicans' fault, they couldn't get it through, or if you're a Republican who thinks they've moved too quickly to these things, the president really is trying to, I'd say, tick off the things on his agenda he wants to do, whether it's climate change or Guantanamo or
immigration.
Or guns or immigration. I mean, you have a list of things that he has, you know, very openly said, look, I can't get it through Congress. I'm going to find every way that I can make an action. And, you know, sometimes the courts are going to limit him, and sometimes he's not going to get the funding to follow through on them. But he has made this his strategy. And I think that's a little different. Some people would say he's a very active lame duck president, but is able to do these things that many second-term presidents wouldn't be able to do. But he has made it his strategy. He's made it a very prominent way of acting. And that's a little different than we've seen, even though others surely have used executive orders.
So, Igor Wolski, do you think that he's using this as a strategy, or is it a defense or a reaction to the fact that he can't get many of his policies through Congress?
It's probably a combination of both. And here I really agree with John. I mean, he's absolutely right about the dynamics of these orders. But I would just point out that Obama at this point has nobody to negotiate with. I mean, he tried. He tried on guns in 2013. The Senate couldn't even move the bill to a vote. They couldn't even get 60 votes to move it to a vote. It failed. And so he took executive action where he could. On immigration, the bill, the bipartisan comprehensive immigration bill, passed the Senate. It didn't even get a vote in the House, so he took executive action where he could. So this president came into Washington with the belief that if you sit across the table from your opponent, like John and I are doing, you can have a reasonable debate, come up with some consensus, bake it into a bipartisan bill, and get it passed. And he found lawmakers on the other side who have no interest at all in working with him. And so, yes, that's what animates his actions.
All right. You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are John Fortier, political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Igor Wolski, from whom you just heard. He's deputy director at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Both are policy groups based here in Washington. We're discussing the politics and substance of the 2016 U.S. legislative agenda and campaign 2016. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab at our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Yome Ige. He's a loyal listener from Ibadan, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, back to you, John Fortier. So we have yet to talk about campaign 2016, which is certainly going to be a factor in what can or can't be achieved this year. So let's take a look at the campaign on the Republican and Democratic sides. We're coming up to the Iowa caucuses. Talk about the significance of that in the New Hampshire primary for candidates on both sides of the aisle.
Well, it's more interesting or fractious or however you want to put it on the Republican side, where we have many candidates and also surprising candidates. Donald Trump is still leads significantly in the polls on the Republican side. Ted Cruz has become a second place candidate. And then after that, you'd put Marco Rubio and a number of others who follow after him. I think, you know, we've all wondered what will happen to Donald Trump once the voting started. I don't think Donald Trump's support is going to collapse, as some thought, but there still is a real question once a voter has to go into a booth and pull a lever, make a choice, that they might reconsider, that they consider things like who's the most electable, who would be best at beating Hillary Clinton. So we'll be watching that. But Donald Trump certainly is doing quite well. Iowa is the first state, and I think, you know, there you will see Ted Cruz, mostly because of his social conservatism, do well there. He has a good chance of winning that race against Donald Trump. And then I think the other dynamic is who among the establishment candidates might rise up. Right now, Marco Rubio looks like the leader among them, but it, you know, trails in the polls behind Trump and Cruz. Could do okay in Iowa, but when one turns to New Hampshire, which is a place more for moderate Republicans or libertarian or less conservative socially Republicans, he's got to do well there. And there's still some others like Chris Christie and Jeb Bush and others who might think they have a chance to unseat him. So it looks possible like we will have a strong three-way race between Trump and Cruz and maybe Marco Rubio or another establishment candidate. But we don't know, and we'll have to see how it shakes out in the first days. On the Democratic side, just quickly, I mean, Hillary Clinton is the leader. She could get surprised by Bernie Sanders in the Iowa, but more likely in New Hampshire. But even if she does, I think her campaign is built for the long haul. I suspect she will be the nominee unless the world turns upside down.
Okay. So Igor Wolski, Hillary Clinton, the nominee, unless, of course, the world turns upside down. Your take on the Democrats and, of course, the Republicans. How do you see Mr. Trump, Ted Cruz doing in both Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, we'll see who'll come out on top in Iowa. Certainly Cruz has the best chance of unseating Trump. And then the question is, well, what's going to happen when you get to New Hampshire? How is the dynamic going to shift? And most importantly, what is Trump going to do? I mean, we see every time he's pushed up against the wall, he fights back hard and he fights back dirty. So when he actually loses, what is he going to do? It's going to be interesting. It's going to be entertaining. And we're all certainly going to be watching. But the problem for Republicans, I think, generally, is partly because of Trump and partly because of Cruz, the party has moved to the right to appeal to a certain very conservative base. And when they come into the general election against Hillary or Bernie or Martin O'Malley or whoever it may be, it's going to be hard for them, I think, to moderate their positions to appeal to a voting demographic that's very different than the conservative base. We're talking about more women. We're talking about more people of color. And whether or not they'll be able to do that successfully will decide, as John said, whether or not they will be able to win and become president in 2016.
Well, John Fortier, are you concerned about the Republicans moving too far to the right, even though this is the primary season and that's what usually happens, and then they sort of move to the center?
Well, I think there are some concerns, realistic concerns. Ted Cruz, I think, is more of a candidate that is pretty far to the right, but is within the bounds of the Republican Party. Some would say that, he could be a very acceptable candidate, but probably couldn't get broad enough coalition to win in a general election. It would look more like a traditional election. Donald Trump is a very unpredictable thing and probably not a good thing for the Republican Party. I wouldn't exactly call him a conservative, as Igor just hinted at him. He has some views that are conservative, but he's a populist in many ways and appeals to moderates in the party and appeals to outsiders and immigration. But he's different enough and has, if you look in matchup polls against Hillary Clinton, doesn't seem to do well at this point. So there's some who would argue that he'll bring new and different people into the polling place, but I think it's a risk with Donald Trump. If Republicans put a strong one of the other more establishment candidates up, they might have a good chance. Marco Rubio would certainly have a good chance to beat a Hillary Clinton or a Democratic challenger. It would be a relatively competitive race. So it would be an interesting case if he gets through. But seeing who gets through is very hard.
And back to you, Igor Volsky, on the Democratic side. So Hillary Clinton, in your view, is pretty much a foregone conclusion. But what type of challenge does Bernie Sanders pose to her?
Well, I don't know if Hillary's a foregone conclusion. We'll have to see what happens. I think Bernie Sanders has a strong ground game in Iowa. Certainly, they've been hinting that that's where they're focusing, that they believe that if they can win Iowa, as President Obama did back in 2007, they could break this perception that she's a foregone conclusion. So again, I don't want to predict anything in politics. You don't know what's going to happen on a whole host of different fronts. But I think probably Iowa and New Hampshire are going to be very decisive. Certainly if Hillary wins both of those races, it's hard to see how Bernie Sanders or anybody else could win the nomination.
All right. And as we conclude, back to you, John Fortier. President Obama is giving his State of the Union address next week. That seems a bit unusual. It seems a bit early this year. Why do you think he's doing that, and what do you think he will be saying?
Well, it is a little earlier than usual, a couple weeks earlier than we typically see. Look, I think the president has been consistent in trying to get to his agenda items, ones that he couldn't get through legislatively or other ways in the first term he wants to hit. And some of those are very popular among Democrats and not so popular among Republicans. So I think he will certainly reemphasize his issues of guns and climate change and openings to Cuba and deals with Iran, things that he will view as accomplishments, things that he has done without the help of Congress and that Congress will view unfavorably. I don't think it's going to be an olive branch to work together. There's not much time to do it. It's going to be trying to list and get to things that are on his agenda and contribute to his legacy.
And the last word to you, Igor, with respect to President Obama's last State of the Union, what do you think he wants to accomplish in that message?
Well, all those issues that John brought up, I agree with. And I would just add income inequality, growing the economy from the middle out. These are all more economic themes that he started talking about when he came into office. You'll remember in the midst of the 2008 financial crisis, and they're important to him. So he'll certainly mention that. And on the climate point, I mean, we forget that a historic agreement, almost the entire world agreeing to limit the emission of greenhouse gases. I mean, that's just a tremendous legacy that I think he will very properly tout.
All right. And we will be having both of you back. I have this funny feeling in the coming weeks and months to talk about the campaign. On that note, I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. As I said, stay tuned to the Voice of America via radio, TV, and the Internet for news and analysis on campaign 2016. I'd like to thank my guest, John Fortier, political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Igor Volsky, deputy director at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Gentlemen, as always, thank you for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.